From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast in which Hank talked with Francis Beckwith, professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University. The following program was pre-recorded. Here now is Hank Hanegraaff.
And welcome to another episode of Hank Unplugged. This is the podcast. It is what takes me out of the studio and right into the study. This is not as didactic, I suppose, leaning forward as it is conversational. Today I have a guy I want you to meet, someone that many people in the intellectual community are very familiar with. And I suppose people around the world are familiar with him in general. But there are probably a few people listening in like flies on the wall who don't know who Francis Beckwith is. And if you're one of those people, I want to introduce him as a philosopher who publishes and teaches in the area of politics, jurisprudence, religion, and ethics. He's a professor of philosophy in church-state studies, and he's the co-director of a program in philosophical studies of religion in the Institute for Studies of Religion at Baylor University. Frank, of course, is a prolific author. He wrote a book called Taking Rights Seriously, Law, Politics, and the Reasonableness of Faith. This was a Cambridge University Press imprint, and I think it won the American Academy of Religion's 2016 Book Award for Excellence in the Study of Religion in the category of Constructive Reflective Studies. If that's not enough for you, way back in 1993, and this was the occasion for me to really get to know Frank Beckwith, he wrote a book called Politically Correct Death, Answering the Arguments for Abortion Rights. And I remember back in those years, I would go through that book and then through it again and then through it again. I dog-eared that book. I quoted from that book. That book was transformational because in that book, I started understanding how significant the life issue really is. Francis Schaeffer once said that this would be the watershed issue of our epoch of time, and he was certainly right about that. I'm talking to Frank as well because both of us made some significant changes in our lives, but we are both deeply committed to the concept of mere Christianity. Frank, I am so delighted to catch up with you. It's been a long time. We haven't talked. Got a letter from you when I converted to Orthodoxy, and it was very, very calming to me. You said, I've been through this. If you want to talk, let's have a conversation.
Well, it's great to be on, Hank. I can testify that I remember when you interviewed me for Politically Correct Death, and we were in the studio together, and I couldn't believe the color coordination that was in the text from notes you had taken and things you wanted to memorize. So I can testify, you did, you know, if it were a record album, we could say you bled it white, right?
Exactly. I mean, I love that book. And of course, you've written many books on the life issue. I mean, this is one of the issues that is a passion for you. Maybe we should start out by talking about this rudimentary issue. Here we live in an age of technology. When you wrote that book, we didn't have the kind of technology that we have today. I mean, people can now examine the evidence and know that a preborn child can actually see the face of a mother and have the cognitive awareness of whether that face is upside down or right side up. So we have great strides in technology, but the abortion issue isn't going away.
Yeah, to me, it's really the watershed issue of our age. I mean, there are many other issues that I think one can link to the abortion issue because they all deal with, to a certain extent, the question of who and what we are and whether we can know it. And the abortion issue raises even a deeper question, and that is, what sort of obligations do we have to those that are more vulnerable than us that we bring into existence. I mean, there's something godlike in the fact that human beings can actually, with God, participate in bringing other human beings into existence. And the idea that we can simply destroy those human beings as a matter of will without any justification is abhorrent. And it was actually that issue really profoundly affected my own sort of development as a Christian in the early 1980s. I was considered myself moderately pro-choice around 1984 or so when I was in graduate school. And one of my fellow graduate students, who believe it or not was an atheist, shot down my pro-choice arguments. And it surprised me how badly I was reasoning. And the other thing that was ironic about it is it was an unbeliever that actually was the one that helped change my mind. But as I began thinking more deeply about the issue, I began to see how it is connected to not only, you know, a sort of obligation we have just to not harm others, but the obligation we have for those that we actually are responsible for bringing into existence. And what that tells us about just ethics in general. Many of the ways in which people reason about this issue always emphasize the struggle and the challenges that a pregnant woman may have. But if you think about it, the idea that our ethics should be driven solely by what we perceive as consequences for ourselves is, I think, ultimately undermining the kind of obligations that do require us to, in fact, move above and beyond what our desires are. I mean, this is what it means to be human.
You know, I think about the experiences I've had, Frank. You know, as you know, I have 12 children. And watching children being birthed is one of the greatest wonders imaginable. To see one human being come out of another human being is truly a miracle. I always watched it without any sense of the blood or the gore that some people get turned off by. It was always a beautiful mystery that was unfolding before my eyes. And, you know, the more you see births take place, the more you know about what happens before a baby is born, the more passion you have about subjects like this.
Yeah, and today, as you mentioned earlier, the technology, we were able to peer into the womb and see things that even people 25, 30 years ago would have never thought imaginable. And yet, the idea that abortion is permissible still persists. And I think it has a lot to do with how people think of their own nature as human persons. Usually, we think about human beings, we think about usually ordinary adult human beings, and those are individuals that have consciousness, are able to reflect on life. And some people, some philosophers will say, well, the unborn aren't like that, so therefore, they're not truly persons. And I think it's a mistaken view of what we are. We're not at any one point of our existence wholly or completely perfected. And so if you think about the human being not as at any one point being complete, you can see that what the unborn human being is just simply one of us at an earlier stage of development, and that the maturation of that being is in fact a movement towards its perfection, but it still is what it is. It doesn't become anything different. It just simply, in a way, it's a kind of unfolding, right, of the majesty of the image of God that we reflect. And yet, you know, it still persists. The good thing is that I think that in terms of the general culture, people are much more inclined to the pro-life position than they were maybe 25, 30 years ago. And I think the technological advances have made that possible.
What about the anthropological problems that persist, though? I mean, if you look today at things that concern you, like gender fluidity or same-sex sexuality, all of these things are part and parcel of a misunderstanding or a misappreciation of the Imago Dei, the image of God in humanity, and how we were created to be by an infinite, ineffable God who is knowable through his graces.
I think you're right. I mean, it's of the same kind of thinking. And let me explain what I mean by that. People today have a kind of dualist view of the human person. Now, I want to be careful here because as Christians, we believe that, in fact, we have souls, and those souls can exist apart from our bodies. So I do believe that as Christians, we accept a kind of dualism in the sense that we believe that there's an immaterial aspect of our nature that does survive death. However, another important aspect of the Christian worldview is that we're going to be resurrected. Why? Because we are embodied souls by nature. We're not simply souls that happen to be tagged onto a body. Well, what does it have to do with abortion and gender issues? Well, insofar as those that want to sort of separate the intellectual part of the person from the physical part of the person can actually say things like, well, I feel like a woman trapped in a man's body. The assumption is that the human body is a kind of instrument of the mind and is not the real self, but the real self is purely the psychological. And tie that to the abortion issue, because the early fetus and embryo isn't psychologically mature, the assumption is it's not truly a person.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Francis Beckwith. In a matter of weeks, the United States of America will have an election. Rarely have elections had consequences on a comparable scale of magnitude. As Christians, we must rise to the occasion. In Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft, Francis Beckwith argues that our public policies become the social and legal fabric of our country, shaping the quality of our national character. If statecraft is indeed soulcraft, Christians can't remain silent at the ballot box. The soul of our country is at stake. To receive your copy of Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.
According to Politics for Christians by Francis Beckwith, a candidate who embraces Christian ideals, even if he or she is not a Christian, is a candidate that a Christian can support with a clear conscience. Christians in America have the historically unique power to enact laws that advance the common good and must take this special obligation seriously by using good judgment while voting and supporting legislation and political candidates. This is not to say that Christians will always agree on what policies and candidates represent the best option to advance the common good, but there is no doubt that Christians have a biblical mandate to advance it. To receive your copy of Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI. Or visit us at equip.org.
The Complete Bible Answer Book, Collector's Edition, Revised and Updated, is a comprehensive collection of the most often asked as well as most difficult questions Hank Hanegraaff has received in nearly three decades of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. This expanded edition contains new entries, leading readers to a better understanding of God and our relationship to Him in Jesus Christ. The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, Revised and Updated, is a comprehensive, handy, and attractive volume that you will return to again and again. Take your exploration of God's Word to new heights and receive the revised and updated Complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Let's now rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and Professor Beckwith in their conversation.
The assumption is that the human body is a kind of instrument of the mind and is not the real self, but the real self is purely the psychological. And tie that to the abortion issue, because the early fetus and embryo isn't psychologically mature, the assumption is it's not truly a person. So you have a very similar reasoning there. And I think the thing that has to be, I think, argued for is that human beings are not simply, you know, our psychological selves. That is certainly an important aspect of us. It's the way we exercise our will. It's the way in which we think. But we're ultimately, though, embodied. Think about it. Even when we think, we have to actually perceive the world that's out there. We are beings that eat and drink and feel and love with our bodies. This is what we are. And so this is why, as Christians, we have to remember what the scriptures teach and then what the tradition teaches, namely that we're not simply this kind of Cartesian view of a thinking thing that happens to be attached to some bit of matter, that we are ensouled, and that what we are as human beings is something that is complex, but it also reflects the way in which God has made us. And he made us not simply as minds attached to bodies, but in fact, embodied souls.
When I hear you talk, I can almost hear Bob and Gretchen Passantino. They had a great impact on your life, just as they had a great impact on my life. I remember when I became president of the Christian Research Institute, I didn't have the acumen that I needed, but there was a man and woman in the background mentoring me, slowly teaching me. And that was something that absolutely radically changed the trajectory of my life and ministry. And I think we have that in common.
Yeah, I met Bob and Gretchen 26 years ago. And for those who have never met the Passantinos, a lot of people haven't, because as you said, they were sort of behind the scenes. But I'll never forget the first time I went to their home, which was this building adjacent to a Lutheran church in Newport, Costa Mesa area. And they had the huge library of books. I remember I walked in and I knocked on the door, and Gretchen answered with this big smile on her face, and she dressed like a hippie right out of Central Casting.
That's right.
And she gave me a big hug and told Bob, Frank Beckwith is here. And then I just remember walking in and seeing the rows of overstuffed bookshelves. And I was there, I think, till 2 a.m., arguing with Bob and Gretchen and sometimes agreeing with them about a variety of theological issues. And the thing that I think really stood out about them was you never got the impression, even if you disagreed with them, that that made any difference. They sort of enjoyed the whole aspect of learning together. When I think of Bob Passantino, I think of Joe Pesci character in My Cousin Vinny. You know, so that was what, so, you know, for those out there listening, this is the way it was. I mean, they were the brightest people I knew, and they had at that time no other than undergraduate education, everything that they were self-taught, but they were so well-read, so well-informed, and because they were so well-read and so well-informed, there was a kind of built-in humility to the way in which they conducted their lives. Even when they felt very strongly about something, they knew enough that they realized that even people who they thought were wrong may have a point. And so there was a wonderful aspect of visiting them. When my wife and I lived in Southern California, we spent many Sunday afternoons at their home, and it was a place, it was almost like Boys Town. People were visiting there all day long, and Gretchen was cooking, and it was wonderful.
and you had to dodge the dogs. And, you know, the toughest thing for me was getting out of there. I mean, I remember the long hours. You know, you have these conversations, they go on and on and on and on. They were very stimulating, but I'd look at my watch and think, I've got something I do early in the morning, and it's 1 o'clock. I got to get out of here. And so you try to make your exit. Bob Passantino, he would walk you to the car.
Yeah.
And then he'd be talking to you, the car window still rolled up. He's still talking to you. Well, you don't want to be rude, so you roll down the car window, and he's talking to you. Then you start leaving. You start driving away very, very slowly, and Bob is keeping up with you as you're driving away. I mean, it was hilarious. I mean, this is a real expression from my perspective of authentic Christianity, because they had a passion for apologetics. They had a passion for always being ready to give an answer to anyone. And so they saw people who had platforms, people like you, people like me, and many, many others. I mean, the tribe can be multiplied many times over, but they saw people that had platforms, and they knew that by investing in those people, they were laying up for themselves treasures in heaven where moth and rust do not corrupt and where thieves do not break in and steal.
Yeah, they were amazing. I think about the times, and I'm sure you've had this too. I would call up Gretchen and I'd say, you know, I have a question about something. I want to get your opinion. And then I hear her after about 10 minutes. She goes, Bob, get on the other line. And Bob would get on the other line, and he would once in a while interrupt in that Bob-like voice. He would say, wait, let me just say this. He would talk like this. And Gretchen would say, be quiet, Frank's speaking. And it was just, we'd be on the phone for sometimes 2 or 3 hours. But yeah, and I would sometimes get calls from Bob at all hours of the night, you know, because I just had this idea. It's amazing. They were an amazing couple, and I miss them dearly.
You know what's cool about all of this is that they were lifelong learners, and I think that is one of the values they instilled in me. Obviously, what I do as president of the Christian Research Institute and host of a daily Bible Answer Man broadcast is I have to be a lifelong learner, can never be static. And they instilled that value in me, continuously wanting to learn to become a sharper tool in the hands of the Holy Spirit. And I suppose if there's a message that we want to get out to people listening into this conversation, it is be a lifelong learner. And I bring this up, Frank, I suppose, because this in some way has to do with my conversion to Orthodoxy and your return to Catholicism. And I suppose maybe as prelude to that, we need to talk about what mere Christianity is, because one of the interesting things that happened when I converted to Orthodoxy after attending an Orthodox church for almost 3 years was that I immediately lost a lot of listenership. A reason being, I lost between 100 and 150 radio stations almost immediately. Of course, other doors have opened up, and so the ministry continues on as before. But a letter from NRB Television President Troy Miller, for example, said, "Dear Hank, it has been brought to our attention through a number of our viewers, external media, and your program that you have converted to Eastern Orthodoxy. It has affected your public ministry and negatively affected our viewership." So as a result of my conversion, there was a slamming of doors all over the world. And I think that if you are a lifelong learner, oftentimes you are not willing to stay pat. And I say that maybe even in light of the fact that Gretchen Passantino died in 2014. I spoke at her funeral, and Bob died before that, and you recognize the brevity of life. And so ultimately, what you do is for an audience of one.
Yeah, the whole idea of lifelong learning, it's something that, you know, that being around them and seeing the way in which they just consumed so much literature. But the thing about it, though, is that they didn't read just to argue for their own positions. I mean, that's certainly not wrong to do that. You want to learn how to defend your faith, but they also read for their own sort of intellectual and spiritual development, wherever that may lead. In fact, soon after I returned to the Catholic Church, Gretchen sent me an email, And I was blown away by it because, you know, we had never talked about Catholicism or anything of that sort. But she told me that her and Bob frequently would talk to each other about me and my wife. And one of the things that Bob apparently said to Gretchen was, I wonder how long it's going to take for Frank to become Catholic. And in fact, this is what she said. This is the email. Many years ago, Bob and I thought you would really enjoy the worship experience of Catholicism, and we were encouraged when you were attending that Anglican church in Newport Beach. I know he is pleased for you as well. Of course, he had since passed away when she wrote that, but the thing that the Pasentinos instilled in me is the same as your experience. And as I've gotten older, I realize how much I don't know. Still, you know, I was telling a couple of my students, I wish I was as sure of myself now as I was when I was 35. I think as a lifelong learner, you begin to realize that there's a limit. You can only read and do so much, and you have to do your best and pray. But there's a wide world out there of knowledge, and you can't know it all.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Be sure to tune in again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Francis Beckwith. Christians can't sit this election out. Although the New Testament speaks very little about government and the Christian's responsibility as a citizen, certain principles from the Bible contribute to understanding why a Christian citizen should have an interest in politics. Politics for Christians by Francis Beckwith offers readers biblical and theological ways to think about politics and the role of the Christian in a liberal democracy. To receive your copy of Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write to CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more.
According to Politics for Christians by Francis Beckwith, a candidate who embraces Christian ideals, even if he or she is not a Christian, is a candidate that a Christian can support with a clear conscience. Christians in America have the historically unique power to enact laws that advance the common good and must take this special obligation seriously by using good judgment while voting and supporting legislation and political candidates. This is not to say that Christians will always agree on what policies and candidates represent the best option to advance the common good, but there is no doubt that Christians have a biblical mandate to advance it. To receive your copy of Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI. Or visit us at equip.org.